Our last speaker is Alan Goldstein. He is the Surgeon-in-Chief at the Massachusetts General Hospital for Children. He'll be speaking to us today about the long-term results and follow-up in patients after surgery for Hirschsprung's disease.
Thank you. Thanks, Shin. And thanks, guys, for organizing this session. My voice is perfect. So I'll give you a brief overview of Hirschsprung and then talk specifically about the issues that children experience as they enter adulthood so that our adult colleagues can be aware of those, and then talk about this transition issue. For those of you who don't know, Hirschsprung's disease is the absence of ganglion cells or nerve cells in the lower part of the intestine, typically just the lower part of the colon. It affects about 1 in 5,000 children, and most commonly it's limited to the rectosigmoid colon as the segment that's aganglionic. That's 80% of cases. And then the other 20% or anything above that, the total colonic aganglionosis in 5% and even extending up into the small intestine. Hirschsprung's disease, the treatment is pretty sort of clear cut. We don't typically operate. They're diagnosed within the first couple days of life. When a baby fails to stool by 48 hours of life, the suspicion arises, the diagnosis gets made, and then usually with rectal irrigations or anal dilations, we temporize until they come to surgery at variable times, 1 month, 2 or 3 months of age. If it's short segment, they get a primary pull-through, and the long segment, they'll usually get a stage repair, like with long segment, they'll get an ileostomy or typically, and then a pull-through later. And the concept is simple. Remove the aganglionic intestine and bring the ganglionic bowel down to the anus. Three classic operations, the Swenson operation, which is just resect the aganglionic part and bring down the colon to the anus. A Suave, where you resect the aganglionic part but retain the muscular cuff of the rectum. That was an attempt by Professor Suave to prevent dissection around the rectum and thereby minimize injury to the parasympathetic innervation. And then the Duhamel operation, in which the aganglionic segment is resected, but the rectum that's aganglionic is left in place, and the ganglionic bowel is brought behind it as a side-to-side pouch. So then you have anterior aganglionic bowel, but it's rectum, which is very important and has absorptive capacity, and posteriorly propulsive ganglionated bowel. The problems that typically occur are actually quite common, and it's becoming apparent that the operations are probably not as good as all of us had thought for so long. Many of these patients will experience obstructive symptoms, which is essentially constipation, fecal incontinence, repeated bouts of enterocolitis, and all of this has quite an impact on quality of life for children. If you look at a group of babies who then become adolescents, as babies they had their pull-through. As adolescents, optimal outcome, which is the same outcome for bowel function as a control cohort, only 50% achieve that. Anywhere from 36 to 45% in these studies had incontinence. If you look at them as adults, in these four studies, the rate of incontinence is as high as 45 or 48%. And again, optimal outcome somewhere around 50%. So these are issues that continue into adolescence and often into adulthood. In this study, 57 patients who were followed for 15 years after their pull-through as infants, 69% had episodes of fecal soiling. 35% were frank fecal accidents. And in this other study of patients who were now in their 40s on average, 92 patients, if you look at their bowel function, soiling in 48%, frank accidents in 14%, and social problems related to bowel function in a third of them. The issue is that Hirschsprung's disease is not just aganglionosis. There's this whole concept of the transition zone, the part between the aganglionic segment and the normal ganglionic, variable levels of hypoganglionosis or abnormal neurotransmitters, as we're learning now. The other problem is the anorectal dysfunction. Everybody with Hirschsprung's disease has no rectoanal inhibitory reflex. That doesn't matter whether before or after your pull through, you never have that. Many of them have colonic dysmotility, and there's other things that we're learning about immune function in the gut and epithelial structure and function that are different. We can fix the aganglionosis. We don't really know how to fix any of these other issues. And to boot, the whole problem of removing a rectum, which is actually a major, you know, ordeal, which we take for granted as surgeons, but the rectum has a lot of important functions. Fecal incontinence, as we query adults and adolescents, so we're learning was historically very underreported. Up to half of patients have some degree of fecal incontinence after their pull-through. The impact of fecal incontinence on a child and an adolescent and an adult on emotional function, sexual function, is really quite impressive, the negative impact it has. Why does incontinence occur after a pull-through? So if these patients go to see an adult surgeon, and I've seen this multiple times, and then they get told there's nothing we can do for you. And I think in general that means I have no idea, and therefore there's nothing we can do for you. But there is, if we understand the etiology of this problem. So after colorectal surgery, there is a phenomenon of hypermotility. The high amplitude propagating contractions are more frequent, and they're greater in number. You also lose the rectum, which is with its reservoir function, and the fact that the high amplitude propagating contractions don't go to the anus, right? They stop at the rectum. Now you have no rectum, now they go all the way to the anus. And the anal sphincter issues, not just the absence of the rectoanal inhibitory reflex, which we can't fix, but the fact that the operation itself may do damage to the nerves and sphincter muscles. So when we see these children, or in the cases where adults have come to pediatric surgeons because they don't know where else to turn, there are ways to address this hypermotility. Simple ways with high fiber diet or the use of loperamide. Amitriptyline we use in some patients. When other things fail, amitriptyline actually is well known to decrease the frequency of high amplitude propagating contractions. And then there's bowel management, which is reserved for the minority of patients for whom nothing else works. More commonly necessary in patients with anorectal malformation, but sometimes needed in children with Hirschsprung's disease. I'll skip through this very briefly. This is an area, the antegrade enema is an area where at Mass General we've collaborated very closely between the pediatric and adult surgeons. It's one example of where I think we were able to teach the adult surgeons something other than subtotal colectomy for their patients with their young women with chronic constipation. But one approach to bowel management, rather than repeated rectal enemas, are antegrade enemas, either through a cecostomy, which is shown here as one of these little Mickey buttons, or as an appendicostomy, where the appendix is imbricated into the cecum and brought out just below at the umbilicus. The idea there is that you can achieve daily evacuation of the colon. So whether you have intractable constipation or fecal incontinence, about 85% of patients overall will experience daily timed bowel movements when they sit on the toilet and flush their colon with whatever concoction you want to come up with. And they will experience no incontinence or much less incontinence because they have a clean rectum the rest of the day. So I would just finish briefly to leave plenty of time for discussion that prepare the child and family to advocate for themselves. It's obvious that when they go to adult doctors, they're just not as nice as us. And so they have to, it's a different approach. Children, we need to get children with Hirschsprung's disease or any operation from saying, I had surgery as a baby, to saying, I had a Suave for short segment Hirschsprung's. That is a world of difference for the surgeon who's going to see that patient. Involve the child in decision making at an earlier stage. So as they grow and you're following them, and once they're, let's say, around 12, you can start explaining the disease to them. And then when they're 14, maybe you say, Mom, why don't you stop talking, and we're only going to let your child ask questions, and you can ask questions later. And so as a staged approach, you can actually, and it's going to be individualized, but we know these children and families really well, so we'll have a good sense of when is the right time to start this stepwise move toward independence. The summary basically is that GI problems continue into adulthood in many patients with Hirschsprung's, not all of them, but about half of them. Treatment doesn't end with the operation. They need long-term and multidisciplinary care, and it's clear that collaboration between pediatric surgeons and colorectal surgeons is essential. It's really easy at a place like Mass General, where we are embedded within one general hospital, so it's a smooth transition for us. It's more challenging at the freestanding children's hospitals where those relationships don't exist. We work very closely with our adult motility colleagues, even if we keep caring for them as surgeons, because the adult motility expertise is incredibly helpful. Adult patients, when they email us and reach out on all the social media places, they need to know that there are adult providers who are willing and able to help. So the more we can sort of develop these collaborative relationships and engage the adult community in the care of these children who are now living, full lives, the better it will be for these children in the long run. Thank you.
Great. So we're going to ask our panelists to come up here, and Shinadel will help moderate some questions. I think we've heard really nice spread here. The themes are, to my take, is that there's still quite an evolution of our understanding about long-term complications or follow-up on pediatric surgery patients, that empowering kids and parents to acquire the data they need to bring it forward is important, that jokes aside, everybody has different strengths and weaknesses in terms of caring for patients, and we're not all fuzzy and they aren't all cruel. You guys have a seat. So I don't know if we have any. Oh, I have a speaker, please.
Hi. Greer Arthur from Philadelphia. I'm a pediatric surgeon, and I'd like to commend the panel. I think this is a very interesting conference and something that I hadn't thought too much about. I certainly remember, which is getting further and further away, my days of fellowship where there was I think late 40s or early 50s man with cystic fibrosis that would come in two or three times a year to be cleaned out with his DEOS. And we would take care of him, and it was really an unusual situation because he was we were taking care of an adult in a pediatric hospital. So things clearly have changed. I have sort of two questions with regards to this. One is, are there patients you think maybe don't ever need to be transitioned? So there are a few patients I've taken care of over the years as an attending now that, they're extremely developmentally delayed, have lots of sort of pure pediatric problems, and are, exclusively taken care of by their parents. And, are those patients appropriate to just continue to treat in the pediatric setting? And two, on the flip side is just curious what everybody's sort of feeling is on something like, a 17 and a half year old or 19 and a half year old who comes in, presents with their first case of, inflammatory bowel disease, or it's finally evolving now to, I think we need to do surgery on this kid, and he's just about to sort of enter the adult world. So I'm just curious on those two ends what the panel's thoughts are.
I feel like we actually have a mixed marriage in my house because my husband's a pediatric surgeon who takes care of very, very rare congenital conditions. And so there really aren't very many people in the world. And so he's always saying, we need adults in this hospital. The tricky part about it is that if you have a 50-year-old or a 60-year-old in your hospital, that means all the rest of the people, the anesthesiologists, the gastroenterologists, the cardiac people, then are taking care of a 60-year-old. So it's tricky, and I think there are some very, very small subsets where it's very helpful. In terms of the delayed patient, one of the things I often go back to my adult colleagues and will say is, you have patients with dementia. You have patients, there are patients who are taken care of by somebody else. I think that developmental delay in and of itself isn't necessarily a reason not to transition somebody. You just have to be careful and do it gradually and make sure they have guardianship. But I think developmental delay is something that really the adults can take care of. What do you think about that?
I would agree. I think it just has to be a very planned transition for some of these cases. But for the most part, I think having the expertise at all the other levels, whether it's an anesthesiologist for an endoscopy or for a surgery, they're going to be better served in the long run in the adult hospital. With the caveat of congenital cardiac stuff, sometimes on that end, they're actually much better off in the pediatric. But I also have several developmentally delayed patients who are fully cared for by their parents, and it should be a matchmaking effort for the pediatric provider to find the right adult provider. But I think if you can, it's best.
I'd just like to ask the pediatric surgeons on the panel what their thoughts are about the kids who have polyposis, which is often almost a planned operation. And if you have a kid at 17, 18, do you pull the trigger and do their restorative proctocolectomy then, or let them trundle on off to the adult world?
You know, it just seemed like an opportunity to come up with something that sounds beautiful. And like, I mean, let's...
I was counting on you.
You know. For years, I was a pediatric surgeon at the Mount Sinai Hospital in Manhattan. And there were a lot of busy surgeons taking care of IBD. So if you were a child was 15 or 16 and went to one of them for either FAP or ulcerative colitis, how could I, in any kind of good conscience, make an issue of it? As a consequence, my patient of the pouches that I did, average age was 11. Which I think is much more interesting than when Fred Alexander looked at the patients at Cleveland Clinic and took all of Fazio's patients, and the average age was about 17. I'm not sure that teaches you anything, you know? But I don't know. It's hard for me to say that a pediatric surgeon should do a pull-through on a 17-year-old when there's somebody in the next room or around the corner who is doing 10 times the volume. I think it just largely becomes a function of being able to justify that. If you can look yourself in the mirror and honestly say, I can do it as well as that individual. I think you could be raising the specter of abandonment. You do a resection for Crohn's, but you look the patient in the eye and say, you know, your next operation, it ain't going to be me. Then why don't you go to the next surgeon? So I kind of am saying uncle to that one. Yeah, so I'm yielding. Yeah.
One way to answer your question in terms of, so depends to me, is if you have a relationship with that patient yet. So sometimes we're involved early on to say, to meet the surgeon, talk about surgery, don't operate. So if that's the case, I think it's a much easier ask to say, hey, Dr. Reed's going to be your surgeon going forward, but he's going to come in the operating room if we can schedule it together. We're going to do the case together. We'll learn a lot from him. He might learn minimal from us, maybe about IV placement or something. But that allows us, and now we're kind of trending a little bit off the topic of this panel, but you know, we are faced with doing more and more operations less and less frequently, and we have people who are super specializing in adult surgery who can probably do that operation much better than we can. So Steve's point about doing an operation on an 11-year-old, well, yes, I'd want a pediatric surgeon in that room, but an adult surgeon would probably have a lot to offer for that if it's a pouch as well. So maybe it's logistically hard, billing is an issue, but if you have adult surgeons at your point, my suggestion, at least to me, would be to say, or I guess I'm suggesting to you, but if I would have the choice, bring the adult surgeon in, have a combined approach, the family realizes you're working together, and then that transition is already set up so that complication or sequelae or next operation in 10 years, then they already had exposure to adult surgery. And you were going to mention something about adults. Care for you.
Well, I think that, you know, we bring up the developmentally delayed patient a lot in pediatric care, and I think that we forget that they don't just have their pediatric diseases, but they get breast cancer and colon cancer and prostate cancer and hypertension and diabetes that they have as adults. And really, in the children's hospital, we aren't well suited to take care of those diseases. So I think that there's a really important transition to be done, but it's certainly difficult. I'd like to embarrass Payam Sadai a little bit. He's one of my partners. He's in the back of the room. He gave us a great grand rounds actually on transitions of care recently, and he probably should have been moderating this instead of me. But in all honesty, he gave us a talk talking about different systems, particularly in Europe and in Canada. Looking at very specific sort of planned transitions, not just for the patients and not just on these one-offs between individuals, but a systems effort. And I believe, and he can correct me if I'm wrong, that one of our colleagues at Columbus has there's a gastroenterologist, if I remember correctly, who has training in both pediatric and adult. And instead of moving the patient around, she comes to the children's hospital and sees the patients at the children's hospital during the transition time so that there's a familiar face and their person that they're going to see at the adult hospital that's a couple miles down the road is a familiar face. I'm just curious what people thought about the idea of maybe this is a new specialty like the adult congenital heart people have, or maybe there needs to be a group of people that are interested in taking care of adults with congenital disease.
The other thing I think that's so interesting, when I have colleagues in other countries where there is that hard stop at 18, you definitely move over. I mean, I think there's something to be said about anticipation. So in Canada, in the Netherlands, in these places, patients know. They know that when they get to be 18, they're going to move. And so there is pressure, just like all of us, you know, procrastinate until you have a paper due, you start it the day before. So patients know, I got to figure out how to do my refills. I got to know how to do this, because they know they're moving over. The hard part here is that it's very wishy-washy, and in our institution, often different divisions and departments will even have different rules. And so it's very hard for patients to say, okay, I'm going to master this, I'm going to write that paper, because they don't know when it's going to happen. And so one of the things I find so difficult about having such mixed messages about what the transfer time is or what the indications are is that we really don't let our patients anticipate. And I often will tell people, five visits worth. I will transfer patients at the end of college, and I will start around age 17 saying, okay, you got a few more visits with me. Okay, you got three more years with me. Okay, you got two more years with me. And I find that drumbeat really helps them, and they, in the last year or so, they magically grow up and master many of the things that we've been working on for a long time.
So some of the particular challenges in that regard are in rural populations where you just don't have access to either specialty. But so, you know, that's the question: should there be itinerant pediatric surgeons? Should pediatric surgeons be consultants? And especially even telemedicine can be helpful. There's legislative questions that address, you know, what sort of insurance questions. I think that drives a lot of parents sometimes to keep their kids coming to pediatrics because it's all done. They've already done all the paperwork. And then there's also, like Laurie said, there's hard stops in some places in the United States where the hospitals won't allow us to care for patients over a certain age, but it's not uniform. Should that be legislated? Should that be, who should drive that? Nobody has an answer.
I'm curious, how many people are at institutions where your institution tells you when you have to move them over versus, so how many people? Just a few. The rest of people have to make their own choices.
And in our profession, pediatricians often drive the bus because they will often keep patients through college to 20. And to me, that's a bit of a overextension. But we'll, you know, sort of, because our hospital wants us to take care of and keep those pediatricians happy, we will see 20-year-olds with gallbladders and hernias, and we can take care of them, but it's not probably the best care for them, especially as things get more complex in longer term.
One of the arguments I make for going through college, because people will ask, well, why do you pick that age group, is you're going from a time frame where they're students and they're moving around a lot, and it's sort of a different mindset. In when we have social workers, they'll work to play up the disability and the accommodation that needs to happen. When they now move to the work world, I remember going to my social worker and saying, okay, my patient is a firefighter, what does he have to tell his boss? And she said, I don't know. It's a whole different world. Then you minimize the disability and you change, the accommodations are different. And by that time also, patients have often picked a city that they're going to live in. So I have many patients who come to Boston or go somewhere for college, and then later on they're going to move to Wyoming, they're going to move to California. And it's interesting because that movement, we have such a mobile society, is often makes it very difficult to do these very planned handoff things. So I think we have to both have some of the transfer, the warm handoffs where you do the joint clinics, but I also think we need to prepare patients and adults to have those random patients that are going to show up from Wyoming or California.
So you're saying single payer, single EMR, portable record?
Of course. I actually make patients take a picture of their summary. It would be nice if they could do a binder, but sometimes I just have a summary and I make them take a picture on their phone, so probably not HIPAA compliant.
I'll
but
be chipped, just
yeah.
Like our pets.
Well, if we don't have any more questions, I'd like to thank our panelists for their participation and their talks. Thank you so much.